This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, June 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. More than 68,000 prison inmates are now reportedly infected with COVID-19, and The Times reports that the number of prison deaths related to the virus has risen by 73% since mid-May. The five largest known virus clusters in the country are inside prisons and jails, numbers that will continue to grow as more protesters are arrested and held in local jails overnight. The Cummins Unit Prison in southeastern Arkansas houses nearly 2,000 inmates, primarily Black men. 956 people in Cummins have tested positive for the virus, making it the 10th largest coronavirus outbreak in the country. Until recently, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson resisted requests to allow inmates to petition for early release. At a press conference on April 13th, he defended that decision.
There's a reason that these inmates are in a maximum security unit. And so I don't see that happening. Now, if it spreads more broadly, there are potential plans that we could look at some offenders that are close to their release date, but we're not close to having to do that now. Let's see where we go from here.
Since then, Hutchinson has allowed the early release of some nonviolent, non-sexual offenders who are within 6 months of their release dates. Rachel Aviv, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss how negligence and a history of racism have made prison populations especially vulnerable to the virus, and how inmates at Cummins have organized to help each other and save lives. Rachel, welcome. I'm so glad to finally have you on the podcast.
Thanks. I'm glad too.
We've all read stories about how the conditions inside prisons and jails exacerbate infection, but none of the ones I've read have really affected me like the piece you just published in The New Yorker, which describes Cummins through the eyes of the men who are incarcerated there. And I thought we might start by having you tell us just a little bit about the history of the prison.
So in 1902, Cummins was founded on two cotton plantations. And from the very beginning, the continuities between slavery and prison were just not even metaphor. I mean, the prison was set up so that it could fund itself and the state didn't have to devote money to the prison system. So it was essentially a farm, and the people who were at the prison were responsible for doing all the labor. And the prison itself saved money by having very few paid employees. Many of the inmates who were called trustees actually acted as the guards, and they had guns and they lived outside of the prison. And it was a self-sustaining operation where the lowest class of prisoners were doing all the hard labor and the upper level of prisoners were supervising them. And there was really no staff trying to make sure that the work was done in a humane way.
You cite Thomas Merton, who was the superintendent of Arkansas's prisons in the 60s, who made some of this public, writing that this system of exploitation mm-hmm. had begun after the Civil War, when farmers and plantation owners forced to free their slaves had to look for a new source of cheap labor. And of course, prisons were the place to do that. What happened to Merton? Was any of that heard and responded to?
He didn't survive. He came in there as a reformer and he left within a few months because he had this idea that he was going to dig up all the bodies of inmates who had been murdered or who he believed had been murdered. And the governor stopped him and fired him. So he basically didn't survive. But in his memoir, he describes the sense that, like, there can't be real reform unless we really understand the depth of the problem. And no one really wanted to follow him on that path.
We can't talk in detail about your reporting methods because we have to protect your sources from retribution. But you spoke at length to several men, and one of whom agreed to let you use his name, DeMarco Rayner. Could you tell us a little bit about him, how old he is, his life sentence, and the group he started, the think tank?
One of the things that I found so striking and upsetting was that I kept talking to these really remarkable men who had been in prison since they were 19 or 20 or 21. They'd been sentenced by juries that were almost entirely white while they were black, or completely white. And often their crimes involved crimes by association, where they were present and someone was killed, but they weren't the person who pulled the trigger, and they ended up with life in prison without parole. So that fact alone felt very unsettling. And DeMarco Rayner was one of a man in this sort of situation who had sort of come to consciousness in prison and had become aware of the social and political and historical circumstances that led him to be where he is today. And
how long has he been there?
He has been there for 20 years. The crime occurred when he was 20, and now he's 41. And so he and this group of men that he called the think tank, they took it upon themselves to sort of think through the problems that they were being faced with. And they held reading groups, and they saw themselves as kind of parent figures for some of the younger men who were coming in. So in the absence of any kind of leadership in the prison, it seemed clear to me that these men had assumed the status of keeping the peace and making sure that like the community of inmates had a sort of reasoned way of responding to the various things that offended their sensibilities.
He's just remarkable. You note that he had ambitions of being a psychiatrist, and he clearly has a teacher's gift. You know, he just talks about these study sessions that they hold about the history of Black people in America. And I think he told you, or maybe he wrote for a recent session, the Black man must be awakened to the knowledge that he is not what this society has taught him to be. What do they read and discuss?
They read all sorts of books, like a lot of history books, a lot of like books about mindfulness, books about how to have good relationships. So they'd spent years like reading and reflecting, and that made them really incredible people, which I think all of them, as they watched this crisis happen, it's something that was troubling for them, is that the conversation about who we let out of prison is always limited to the nonviolent offenders. And all of these men would be classified as violent offenders. But the question is, like, when were they violent offenders, and what has happened in the two decades since these acts occurred? And so I think that was hard for them to feel like they had done so much work reforming their character, and to know that the conversation about whether or not they can be released just doesn't apply to them.
Rayner told you that he sees Cummins as a microcosm of America with its own ghetto and suburbs, as he put it. What did he mean exactly?
So the way that this first came up in conversation was, he was talking about his work as a porter in the infirmary a few years ago. And he had noticed that the infirmary operated the way that a lot of hospitals in America operate, which is that depending on where you live, you get a different kind of medical care. And in the prison, he noticed that people who lived on the West Hall were treated with less suspicion than people who lived on the East Hall. And on the East Hall are the prisoners who work on what's called the hoe squad. So every day they pack into this trailer, they go out into the fields and they pick cotton and they pick vegetables, and they have to work 8 hours a day. And then on the West Hall are the men who get to work like the so-called good jobs, which is they work indoors, they work in the front lawn. Some of them even work on what's known as the free line, which is this community for prison employees and their families. So he noticed this clear division in the prison, and it really didn't surprise him that the outbreak began on the East Hall, where the men are seen as sort of living in the ghetto, as he put it.
Over the decades, there has been at least one class action suit by prisoners charging Cummins with cruel and unusual punishment. And I think you mentioned an internal investigation against acts of racism. What were the results of those complaints?
There was a lawsuit in 1970, and it was really significant in the history of prison reform, because the judge said that the entire Arkansas state prison system was unconstitutional, that essentially anyone living in that prison system was being subject to cruel and unusual punishment. And so there were reforms that were made in the 70s. For instance, previously, people who didn't pick enough cotton could be told to lie down on the ground and pull down their pants, and they would be whipped with a 5-foot leather strap. So something like that was no longer allowed. But the dynamic of having too many prisoners and too few paid staff, and this general neglect for medical needs or for the need for rehabilitation, that really didn't change very much. And the kind of racist undertone to, I mean, the internal investigation in 1992 found that Black prisoners were 10 times more likely to be assigned the job of shining officer shoes than other prisoners. So clearly the racial dynamics there didn't change. And from the beginning, Cummins had been designed as a prison for Black men because it was thought that only Black men were able to work in the fields in this sort of hot, muggy area.
How did Cummins become the site of the 10th largest outbreak in the country?
No one really knows exactly how the virus got into the prison. What they do know is that the first person to test positive was an officer who worked on the farm. And a spokesman for the prison had said, well, that doesn't matter because that farm worker wouldn't have interacted with inmates because that person wasn't inside prison walls. But everyone I talked to said that that was an absurd idea because officers are constantly interacting with inmates. And one of the refrains that people kept repeating was that essentially inmates still run the prison. Inmates do all the work. And so an officer really can't get through a day without interacting with inmates. So they believe that an officer brought the virus in and it spread rapidly from there.
They do all the work, but as one person told you, I think it was a worker there, the mentality of the infirmary is these people are worthless. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the mentality of the healthcare workers at Cummins and how they, what role they play in perpetuating the lack of protections against infection.
Yeah, I mean, I am really troubled by this because WellPath is, it's a for-profit healthcare provider that provides the healthcare in all of Arkansas's prisons. But it's not just Arkansas, it's many states throughout the country. And the complaints against WellPath are everywhere. So I talked to a nurse and a physician's assistant. Both had worked in several Arkansas prisons. And they said that there's this kind of assimilation process where you're told to essentially view your potential patients as con men and not to be fooled by them. So you should distrust when they tell you that they're sick, and you should try to avoid having to send them to the hospital.
And they shred slips with health requests.
Right. And so WellPath will be fined if it takes longer than 3 days to respond to a sick call. So one of the nurses told me that in order to get around that problem, they would actually just shred the sick calls. And then there were other ways too, like they would purposely wait to submit a sick call until after midnight so they would get extra time. The medical care was completely detached from the needs of the inmates. It's like they had almost lost sight of what they were doing. One of the nurses who was present throughout this crisis, she has a federal lawsuit against her for wrapping a telephone cord around an inmate's neck while another nurse blocked the surveillance camera. So there was just this general disdain for inmates that felt cultural as well as, I mean, obviously there are economic factors too, that sending someone to a hospital costs more money and it's a system without much money.
And then the testing process is farcical. Rayner told you that, you know, after a number of them had on his barracks had been tested, a sergeant shouted in, "Y'all are negative." So what happened then?
So then he had his cousin call the prison central office to find out his results. And then a number of other people in his barracks started doing the same thing. And eventually the prison central office said, "We're not going to give out results on the phone anymore." And several days later, they all received paper slips telling them that they were actually positive. The idea that people were sick, it just didn't seem to matter.
And the guards went to work knowing they had the virus.
Right. So, and that was the official policy. The official policy was that guards who tested positive but were asymptomatic should continue going to work. They were technically supposed to work only positive barracks, but one guy that I talked to said that he lived in a positive barracks and he asked the guard who came to his barracks, "Oh, this must mean you're positive. That's what our newspaper says." And she said, "Oh, no, I haven't been tested." I think they were so short-staffed that they just didn't care.
So Rayner, he and the think tank in general also really did their best to try to prevent the inmates from rioting as conditions got worse and worse. How did that all go?
Well, they were able to talk to the people in their individual barracks. But one of the things that a man named Kadir told me is that he would try to explain to the officers, like, we work 8 hours a day, every day, for free. If we commit like a small infraction, try to think about whether it makes sense to put us in isolation for 15 days for eating an orange or whatever it is. And then on the other hand, he would talk to the inmates and say, like, these corrections officers are working 10-hour shifts. They drive an hour home to their family, and imagine what it's like for them to get a phone call from the prison saying you have to drive back because there's some disruption. So there was this, a sense of trying to kind of enlarge people's perspectives and think about other ways of getting attention beyond like busting the windows out of a barracks.
And then on April 19th, Governor Hutchinson had another press conference, and he said, you know, trying to put the best spin on this, that cases in the state were decreasing, but only if incarcerated people, and at Cummins specifically, were removed from the calculus. And Kadir had an amazing response to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he just said, like, you know, this is 2020, like, think about this, that we're not even counted as a statistic. No one is counting us even when we're sick or dying. And another man told me, like, some men can't even think about that. Like, it's just too upsetting to wrap their minds around, and they'd rather not even think about it.
Kadir also talked about the protests in response to the police officer's killing of George Floyd. What did he have to say about that?
I mean, this happened towards the end of my reporting the story, and there was this sense of like relief and hope that the country was, they had spent so much time reflecting on how they got to prison and why they were in prison for so long. And I think to see that there was like a national conversation about the way that slavery has shaped this country, like, felt like a moment of hope. And Kadir said something to me that, like, every year he goes to, it's called classification. So he files into this office where there are all these supervisors from different parts of the prison. And the way he put it was, they essentially make bids on you like a horse. Like, they decide where in the prison you're going to work. And he said, like, he gets this strong gut feeling, like the blood that pumps through his veins is the blood of his ancestors. And I think for him, seeing the protests was really affirming of this kind of recognition that he has had to come to over the years.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel Aviv is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.